Welcome to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders, hosted by Mike Tsakopoulos and produced by the American Association for Physician Leadership.
An event hits mid-career and makes a person see they are on the wrong side of a topic, a bell that can't be unrung. My guest today had one of those moments that changed the trajectory of his career, from a third-party payer executive to physician advocate. Next on Sound Practice. My guest today is Ron Howergan. Ron is president and CEO of Fulcrum Strategies. He was a senior level executive with managed care companies such as Cigna, Kaiser Permanente, and Blue Cross Blue Shield. Ron is the author of Clear, Reforming Healthcare to Save the U.S. Economy, and Flatlining, How Healthcare Could Kill the U.S. Economy. Ron Howergan, welcome to Sound Practice.
Well, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my absolute pleasure. Maybe you could tell our audience a little bit more about your background. I gave the briefest of brief introduction, but I'm sure people would be interested in your path as a healthcare executive.
Sure, absolutely, be happy to. So I've been working in healthcare almost four decades now. I've got about 38 years in, so I've seen an awful lot of change. I started my career working for various insurance companies, Kaiser, Cigna, Blue Cross. What I did for those insurance companies was what they call network management. I negotiated contracts against doctors and hospitals, so I would negotiate how much they were going to get paid for providing the services they did. Did that for about 18 years, started to get a little disillusioned with what the for-profit stock-traded health insurance companies were doing to the practice of medicine and the disincentives or the conflicts that were created there. So I'll tell you a really quick story. My wife was pregnant with our second child. I was working for a Blue Cross plan. I had reduced the reimbursement for her obstetrician about 6 weeks prior to her delivery, not something she was thrilled about. And we had a C-section. I'm holding a beautiful baby boy. I'm thanking everybody in the room, every doctor there. Heck, I think I thanked the surgical tray. And the obstetrician did what doctors do every day. He didn't take a victory lap. He didn't pat himself on the back. He said, hey, it's all part of the job. I'm glad it all worked out. But then as he was leaving the OR, he stopped and he turned around and he said, hey, Ron, the next time you take money out of a doctor's pocket, please remember tonight because I'm the guy that was here. And I just felt crushed. And so I decided to take paternity leave and switch sides and start a consulting company. So I started Fulcrum Strategies, started to spend the rest of my career helping doctors and hospitals with their managed care contracts. That baby boy is now 21 and will be a junior in college next year. And so I've spent the last 20 years working for doctors and hospitals, trying to help them navigate what is a very complex system and environment. So that's what I can do 40 years of my career in about a minute and a half. That maybe is a little concerning, but that's my background.
Well, very, very interesting. Now, in some of your writings and previous interviews, I've heard you say that when it comes to third-party payers, that it's really all about the money. And I assume that that's both a explanation and a criticism of our healthcare system. Is the capitalist economy just a bad fit for quality public healthcare?
It has some inherent flaws and problems. And first of all, you got to understand the for-profit insurance companies, Cigna, Aetna, United, those folks, Anthem, they're doing what they're supposed to do. In a pure sense, if you are a stock-traded for-profit company, your job is to maximize shareholders' investment, period, hard stop. If you're not doing that, you can actually be sued by your shareholders. Now, the problem with healthcare, as opposed to other markets or other industries, in most other industries, the best way to maximize a shareholder's investment is to build a better product or service for the customer. You know, Apple maximizes shareholder by providing good products, by providing a great phone and a great computer. The problem with healthcare is the customer is not the purchaser. So the patient typically is not who's buying the product. That's usually either the government or an employer. And the way to maximize the shareholders' investment for somebody like a United Healthcare or Cigna is oftentimes to do something that's not good for the customer, to deny care or to make care harder to provide, et cetera. So there's this inherent disconnect that isn't present in other industries. So it's not that the insurance companies are inherently evil. It's that their goal is sometimes at odds with the patient. And we either need to figure out a way to fix that incentive or have a different system. So long-winded way to say our current system, our current capitalistic for-profit system, yes, is a problem for healthcare. And that's why it's so broken.
In your lifetime, has the patient experience with healthcare changed?
Oh, I think it's changed dramatically. And I think every physician out there would tell you the same thing. I have a lot of clients who've been practicing medicine for a long time who will say, you know, when I started doing this, the medicine was the hard part. You know, keeping up with changes in technologies and drugs, et cetera, that was the hard part. And now the hard part is, how do I get the patient what they need? How do I navigate this horrible system of prior authorization and denial? And, you know, it's the bureaucracy of healthcare that's the hard part. That, to me, is telling and sad. And tells me that then the patient who's on the other end of that has a very different experience. Now, they've got the same problem. How do I get the drug I need? How do I get the service I need? How do I get it paid for? So I think it's changed pretty dramatically over the last, 30, 40 years.
In my time as in practice, I've seen physicians go from being self-employed to being employed by organizations not run or controlled by physicians in large numbers. Do you think that interferes with the physician-patient relationship?
Absolutely. I think one of the things in our system that is one of the best parts about it that hopefully we can preserve that is starting to fail is that the independent practice of medicine. When I'm in the exam room with my physician, they're working for me. There's nobody above them telling them what they can and can't do. Once that goes away and a physician either is sold to or sells to a hospital or, the second largest employer of physicians in this country is an insurance company, United Healthcare, then you've got a question. Are they doing what's right for me or are they doing what's right for their owner? And that to me is a huge problem. Also, most of the physicians who either are surveyed or I talk to want to be independent. They're not selling to a hospital or to, United or whatever, because they want to. They feel like they have to, like they've got no other choice. And that's also another problematic scenario. Again, I'm not saying every hospital-owned physician provides bad care, but it raises that question of who are they really working for? Is it me or whoever cuts their paycheck, so to speak?
As long as we're looking at the dark underbelly of things, Ron, mm-hmm. Let's talk about demographics of our physician population. We're in the midst of an enormous wave of retirement of physicians, are we not? Do you think that will impact reimbursements? Traditional economics would say supply demand, right? That as the supply of physicians goes down, they should be able to command more money. But that may not apply in this model. What are your thoughts on where we're headed healthcare-wise, both as far as providing healthcare and as far as reimbursement for physicians?
I think it will eventually happen, but I think some things are going to happen before then. So you're absolutely right. I mean, more than 50% of all the practicing physicians right now are over the age of 55. They're going to retire in the next 10 years. So we're going to lose more than half of all the practicing physicians in this country. We already know we don't have enough physicians in training to replace them. And what's even more concerning is there was a recent survey of nursing students and medical students, people who are currently in training. Over 60% of them said they had no plans on using their education for direct patient care after they graduate. That's staggering. We already don't have enough in training to replace those going. And if even half of that, if only a third of them don't go into direct patient care, we're in serious trouble. So we are going to have a massive supply problem. I think the first ways we're going to feel it is there are going to be probably what you would call the most needy of the populations who have a hard time getting care, Medicare and Medicaid, which typically are the worst paying payers out there. I already see a lot of physicians who limit or end or have stopped providing care to Medicare and Medicaid patients. So our elderly and our poor, who you could argue and disabled, who need care the most, are going to have a hard time finding it. then eventually, I think it will, after that, after we have some of these access problems, it will start to drive up reimbursement. But it'll be slow, and we'll face some access, serious access issues before that happens. And the problem with that is it will take a long time to recover, because you can't make a doctor on a six-week course. You know, you're talking 12 to 14 years of training from start to finish. So once we realize we've got a supply problem and an access problem, it won't be solved overnight. I had one doctor who reminded me that it's a little bit like, he said, you know, making a doctor is a little bit like making fine bourbon. It has to age in the barrel for 10 or 12 years before it's ready. And he said, you can't speed that up. And he's right. And so if you have a supply problem, it's going to be that way for a while.
Touched on Medicare, Medicaid. What do you expect to see out of CMS concerning reimbursements in the next few years?
I think until it gets really bad, we're not going to see anything different than what we've seen before. We are on the end of 5 straight years of Medicare reimbursement cuts, 5 years in a row. Over the last 5 years, they've cut reimbursement to physicians by 10%. During that 5 years, inflation, just general inflation, has gone up by 23%. So in real dollars, doctors have lost a third of their reimbursement from Medicare, and it wasn't good to reimbursement to begin with. I don't think Medicare is going to change that until things get really bad. And really bad meaning doctors stop doing it. The reason why, I had one doctor ask me, you know, why does Medicare keep cutting us? And I said, unfortunately, it's a little bit like the abused wife who says, why does he keep beating me? And the answer is because you don't leave, you know, because you keep seeing the patients, you allow it. And so I think it's going to be bad until that happens. And because physicians are so dedicated to helping people, they'll take the beatings for a while.
Yeah, that's sad that we have a system that at least in part preys upon the provider's goodwill.
Yes, absolutely.
This is becoming overly depressing, Ron. We got to talk about some solutions, my friend.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And you had one that an idea that you raised that I have to say I really liked, and that's that medical directors for third-party payers should be held to the standard of practicing medicine when approving or denying claims. And I got to tell you, I really like this idea. Can you talk a little bit more about it?
Yeah. So one of the incredibly frustrating things in healthcare is you go see your doctor says you need X, Y, or Z. And then they've got to ask permission for that to be paid for by the insurance company. And someone who is unfamiliar with you as a patient, a doctor, says yes or no. And they often do so with very little review. There have been stories that have outlined Cigna medical directors denying things once every 1.2 seconds. Well, I met some really gifted physicians, and none of them can do a diagnosis in 1.2 seconds. Or after something happens, somebody retroactively looks and says, I don't think that we should have paid for this, and then they deny it retrospectively. So my idea is this. Look, if a doctor is going to say that you shouldn't get a certain service or that it's not medically necessary, which is how they deny things, we're not talking about you don't have a benefit for it. You know, this is not medically necessary. And that doctor is going to sign off on it. That should be the act of practicing medicine, because much like a doctor ordering something incorrectly for you or missing a test, that can have a negative impact on your care. Okay. So if you defined it as the act of practicing medicine, then suddenly that medical director has a certain amount of responsibilities. One, they have to be practicing with a license. They have to be practicing within their field. They have to be practicing in the state where they have a license. And they would have to create a medical record. If they're going to review something for you and say you should or shouldn't get it, they should create a medical record, just like the doctor who ordered it. And finally, if they're wrong and if they're negligent in that, they should be held responsible for malpractice, just like the doctor who ordered something wrong or who did the wrong procedure or whatever. If we did that, first of all, it would clean up a massive amount of these auto denials where it's just a computer denying it. And it would still allow the carriers to look for inappropriate utilization or care. They would just have to do it with a whole lot more review than that. And it would get rid of a lot of that frustration. It would drive a lot of administrative cost out of the system. And it would make doctors' lives so much easier because they hate that stuff. You know, you're a board-certified, subspecialized neurologist in MS, and you order something for your patient, and you got to get on the phone, hopefully, with another physician who's never seen that patient, maybe doesn't specialize, maybe isn't even a neurologist, who's telling you what you can and cannot have. That's something that would be an easy legislative fix, because you just take, you add a definition, and it would solve an enormous problem within our system, and patients would get better care faster.
We've seen a similar use of the definition of practice of medicine with expert witnesses testifying, and that a number of states, I think the majority of states now, consider offering testimony in a malpractice action as the practice of medicine, thereby subjecting the physician to penalty. So I think it's a great idea, and boards of medicine could really do some good for the physician community.
Right.
So, well, and it's great and idea.
It's not unusual. I mean, your profession has a similar issue. You can't practice law without a license, and there are certain things that you can and can't do without it being considered practicing law. CPAs have the same thing with their licensure. This is not an unusual hurdle to say, if you're going to practice that which you went to school for and you're trained for, it comes with some responsibilities, and that's fine. And again, I don't want to take away an insurance company's right to look at bad actors. There are bad doctors out there, and say you shouldn't be providing this, but they should do it with enough care and responsibility for what they're doing, because they can impact patient care. And sometimes it's just, the stories are horrendous. I won't go into the whole story, but I got in touch with a physician, an ENT physician, who ended up dying of cancer, a horrible diagnosis. He was trying to fight against this stuff in his last days. His wife is a physician, and I was talking to her after his passing. And she said, yeah, 6 weeks after he died, I got a letter in the mail from our insurance company retroactively denying $80,000 of chemotherapy. Now, that's just morally reprehensible. She's still dealing with the loss of her husband, raising her children on her own. And somebody somewhere looked retroactively and said, I don't think this chemotherapy was necessary. We're going to deny this claim. That's undefensible.
It certainly has engendered a lot of hostility in the general public. And I think that we saw that with the murder of the United Healthcare executive. Were you surprised by the public reaction to that shooting?
You know, what's sad, and I had met Brian a couple of times, and when the news first came out about the shooting, my wife and I were seeing it, and I said, that's a disgruntled patient. And she said, no, it's not. And I said, I'll bet you dollars to donuts it is. And she said, why? And I said, to be honest with you, as horrible as it is, and it was murder, and no one will ever tell me that it was acceptable for whatever reason, it's not. I said, I'm kind of surprised it hasn't happened beforehand. But then the public reaction to it, the complete lack of, in social media or whatever, of empathy for his family. And I don't think the people who were doing it, they didn't know him, and it wasn't personal, but it was an ability to vent a global frustration with the system. And that backlash and that vitriol and that complete lack of empathy should show us that there's an enormous problem here, because it was just huge. And if anything positive can come from an individual's death, maybe it's if it starts and continues a discussion about how we change this, because clearly something's wrong.
You've been surprised by the lack of legislation on this just whole general topic. We've had No Surprises Act, some prompt pay kind of thing. But to me, it all seems around the margins. I've been surprised. What are your thoughts?
Well, I am and I'm not. I'm surprised because it's such a problem. I'm not because of how much money is involved. You know, there's serious lobbying to keep the status quo for the people who are making money at it. One of the things that an example I tell people to get the money involved. If you had invested $100,000 in United Healthcare stock, and this, it's very similar numbers for the others, I'm not picking on United. If you invested $100,000 in United Healthcare stock 25 years ago, today you would have over $50 million. Okay, 25 years ago, United Healthcare was trading at about $7.50 a share. It split three times in the last 25 years. So the shares you bought then, the roughly 14,000 shares, would be split three times. It'd be over 100,000 shares now. And it's trading over $500 a share. That's how much money is involved. That's enormous. So anything that sort of goes at that profit margin, and many of these changes would, is going to be met with resistance. In addition, anything that goes at the increasing the cost for Medicare and Medicaid to the government has a huge impact on the budget. So that's the resistance. And going back to that, doctors are by nature good-hearted people who will continue to do things. They just sort of continue to take it, which has made it difficult for legislation to get passed. I'm hopeful that it will happen more now, but we haven't seen enough yet. It's been band-aids on bullet wounds up till now.
Public perception of the medical profession post-COVID, what do you think?
So I was really happy with the public perception of the medical profession after COVID, much like I like when people walk up to somebody who's served in our armed forces and say, thank you for your service. There was an appreciation for what these people went through. I don't think people fully understood how difficult it was. I recently have watched the show The Pit about an ER. It makes me cringe just to watch it and think that the public needs to. Everybody should watch it and appreciate what doctors do. And they're not gods, but man, they do a hard job. And I can't imagine what they go through. But I've seen that sort of, and we've got a short memory, sort of tail off a little bit. And I don't think we took advantage of that perception when we should have. There was a time when we could have struck when the iron was hot and get some legislation, but we were too busy just recovering from the worst pandemic we'd seen in 100 years. So I think the public still appreciates, trusts physicians. I don't think they fully understand just how much they do, how hard their job is, and how much we are potentially doing damage to that profession.
Interested in your thoughts on private equities in the last recent years' foray into healthcare. What are your thoughts? Is that going to be to the benefit of physicians?
So, and this, let me explain this statement in a second, because people will take it. Private equity is like firearms, okay? Now, can be a useful tool in the hands of a trained professional, and can also be a horrible thing in the hands of somebody who's not trained. And so it's not the item that's the problem, is how it's used. And I think same thing with private equity. Private equity can be, and has been in some situations, an incredibly valuable way for medical practices and other delivery of care to finance, you know, to collect capital for growth, et cetera. And there are organizations out there who are PE backed who do a wonderful job. It can also be like, you know, I heard somebody say, you know, private equity is like giving guns to children. We're not sure what's going to happen, but it is going to be exciting. And it can also be incredibly dangerous because it can inject the very thing that we don't like about insurance companies, which is a profit motivation on healthcare. And you can have an owner who says, I need an X percent rate of return. And so you, doctor, start prescribing this drug because it has a better margin. And then it can put the doctor in a position of, well, that's not the best drug for my patient, or start doing more of these procedures, even though they're not necessary. So to me, PE isn't in and of itself good or bad. It depends on how it's used. I would like to see more controls on it, more guide rails for the bad actors. And I think the people who are doing it well get painted with a bad brush sometimes because of the bad actors.
Interesting. And I think you're correct on that. Tell me about Fulcrum Strategies.
So, well, you heard the story how I started. I decided that I wanted to sort of devote the last part of my career to trying to help doctors. And so what we do is we represent physicians in their negotiations with carriers, try to get them equitable reimbursement, fair contractual terms. I tell people, my job is to try to help doctors be doctors. You know, if I do my job, they don't have to worry about some of the stuff, and they've got enough revenue to care for the patients they want to care for. I have a client who was looking at dropping Medicaid, and they lost money on Medicaid. Every patient they saw, they lost money. And they didn't want to do it because they said, well, where are these kids going to go? It was a specialty group. And one of the doctors said, you know, because you've gotten us enough reimbursement on the other stuff we see, it allows us to do this and take a loss and still be able to have a decent living. And that's exactly what I'm trying to do, because they really wanted to care for these kids. And because we were able to get them effective contracts on the other side, they could.
Do you have a specific geographic area of the country that you work in, or a specific area of medicine
No, we work in all specialties. We've worked in 30 states so far. We've got people, I think, in 18 or 19 states right now. We do only physicians and a few rural hospitals. I don't do anything with payers or anything like that. So we try to stay sort of pure from that perspective. But yeah, we'll look at anything.
As our time together draws to a close, I know some people listening would certainly like to connect with you. How may they best reach you?
I'd say just they can go to our website. It's fsdoc.com. Or they can look me up or whatever. But we're more than happy to talk to them and try to help them out.
My guest has been Ron Harrigan. Ron, thank you so much for being on Sound Practice.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed the discussion.
My thanks to Ron Harrigan for his time and efforts on behalf of physicians. His work at Fulcrum Strategies is important to healthcare providers and to a healthcare system out of balance. My thanks also to the American Association for Physician Leadership for making this podcast possible. Please join me next time on Sound Practice. We release a new episode every other Wednesday.
You've been listening to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders. Check out the show notes for this episode at soundpractice.com. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear them. Email us at info@soundpractice.com. Subscribe to Sound Practice wherever you listen to podcasts so you can automatically receive our episodes. And please rate us and comment on the podcast in iTunes and Google Play. Sound Practice is presented and produced by the team at American Association for Physician Leadership. We are the world's premier organization for all aspects of physician leadership in every sector of healthcare. Learn more at physicianleaders.org. Batman and Robin, Red Bull Kapow.